What are the causes of inequality in the UK? What are its effects and what can we do about it now? And I'm really glad that we have such a fantastic range of speakers to discuss these issues. I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they'll speak, and I should just point out that they chose the order. So firstly, we have Danny Dorling, who's Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. His many books include The Equality Effect, Do We Need Economic Inequality, and Inequality and the 1%. He's the co-creator of a website called World Mapper, which shows who's got most and least in the world. And his next book, which is out in July, is called Peak Inequality. And you can see these flies are outside. Secondly, we have Imogen Tyler, who's Professor of Sociology at the University of Lancaster. She's the author of Revolting Subjects, Social Abjection and Resistance in Neoliberal Britain, the co-editor of Immigrant Protest, and her forthcoming book is called Stigma Machines. And then last but definitely not least, we have Akugo Amajulu, who's Professor of Sociology at the University of Warwick. Her books include Minority Women and Austerity and Community Development as Micropolitics, as well as the forthcoming To Exist is to Resist Black Feminism in Europe. And she was a community and trade union organiser in both the States and Britain before coming into academia. So they're all going to talk for about 25 minutes each, roughly, one after the other, and then we'll open the floor for questions. Afterwards, we have a reception outside where you can also see material from the wonderful Equality Trust, who have a stall, both on the work of the Equality Trust in general and also their project, My Fair London. And there's some volunteers there who can talk to you about it if you want to do so. Okay, so I'll turn the floor over to you first, Danny.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let me stand up over here. Can you hear me okay at the back? Great. I'm going to talk mainly about money and income inequality because our next two speakers are going to cover everything else. Hopefully. I've written too many books about inequality. I've partly written them because publishers have asked. And they've asked because the demand for books on inequality is so big, because the problem is so large and the problem has become worse. And politically, it has become realised that this is an issue. So the Labour Party now has inequality at its heart as a core issue. It is clever enough to realise that you can't just say inequality is the problem because a gap is too nefarious a thing to galvanise people about. But if I go back 10 years in my life, when I first worked as a researcher for government, this is before 1997, we were not allowed to use the word poverty in government reports. Things really have changed. Can I ask you to look at three things? What are the causes? Why are we such an unequal country? What are the effects? What's it actually doing to us? And what we can do about it. But first I want to just do a little bit on the history for anybody who doesn't know. And the nice thing is that these things are no longer disputed. Little graph here. This little graph starts around about 1921. This is a share of income, the best of 10%. Around about 1921, they had about 40% of all income. This drops and drops and drops. Peak inequality was 1913. Almost everywhere in the rich world, peak inequality was 1913. Drops and drops and drops and drops, right through the 60s and through the 70s. So I grew up as a child at the time of greatest equality this country has ever known in terms of income. Of all European countries, all countries larger than a few million people, only Sweden was more equitable than this country when I was a child. This table here is showing you the OECD league table for inequality, the Gini coefficient as produced by OECD. And it shows where we are now. Remember, we were the second most equal country in the 70s. So the worst country for inequality is Mexico. The next is Chile, and then Turkey, and then the USA, and then Lithuania bumped in for about half a year, it's now out. Russia, and then us. Now, given that Lithuania's now out, Lithuania and Estonia keep on annoyingly bumping up there. But bar them, we are the most economically unequal country in Europe, now playing the game of including the most tiny countries. We are, if you like, if you think of Europe as the United States, we are the Texans of Europe. We're the brass, strange, weird, kind of self-confident people who don't realise we've got a problem. Our income inequality is bigger than in Israel. The gaps between us in terms of how much we pay each other are bigger than in Israel. That is Israel statistics, including the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That's what kind of a country we are. Now, we don't have people shooting through fences in this country, but we do have that extent of gaps in how much we think people are worth. And the reason I bang on about income inequality is that essentially you tell somebody how much you respect them by how much you pay them. So if you pay somebody to clean this room a certain amount, and it's less than in another country, that is directly telling them what you think they are worth. I once sat in a meeting in the university where a colleague argued that we should not pay the living wage to the cleaners because they were not worth it. And the money we could save by not paying the living wage could be used to buy a book to give to a clever student who was worth it. This is fundamentally what these things are about. The rise begins around about 1978-79, and it's relentless, and now we are currently at an interesting point. Nowhere else in Europe has seen that. The USA is kind of like that. I won't read all the other countries. Sometimes it makes me quite sad. The great news of this chart is that the only way is progress. That's the only way we can go. We are at the bottom of the class in Europe. Things are going to get better. The only question is how quickly and how fast. This is the country shaped by the super rich from a couple of years ago. It's very similar to the Sunday Times rich list most recently. Regions are sized by the wealth of the richest 1,000 people. Half of them live in London, the richer ones live in London. If you've got good eyesight, you can see the richest 10. They have a third of all the wealth of the richest 500 families. So you can be in the Sunday Times magazine that came out last weekend, the weekend before. And you can feel poor in the rich list. This may seem strange to you, but when you have this kind of incredible slope of inequality, nobody, apart from the kind of top 10 families, actually thinks that they are rich. It is bizarre. It's very, very strange. Again, do any of you get the rich list just out of interest? Anybody have a look at it? I only buy the Sunday Times once a year for this. It has a table of the biggest 50 donors from the 1,000 richest families, donors to political parties, and who they give. At the top, I've forgotten who it was, they gave 2.7 million out of last year. Can you guess which party? Okay, 2.7 million to the Conservative Party. Next, Conservative, 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 Conservative. SNP, one. Conservative, 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 Conservative. UKIP, one. Conservative, all the way down to the bottom, where Lord McAlpine was having a bad year and gave him only £70,000. But this is why it's worth buying the Sunday Times rich list. The rich only donate to one political party in the interest of one thing, which is maintaining the inequality. Why? What are the causes? That red dwarf quote there about empire. If you're trying to work out why us of all of Europe, what's different about us? Nowhere else in Europe was 100 years ago the centre of the biggest empire the world has ever known. If you want an excuse as to why Britain has become so unequal, I think legacy of empire. This is the kind of burnt out capital of a former empire, and there's empire attitudes at play here. The three largest cities in or on the edge of Europe are London, Moscow and Istanbul. All three of them are hearts of former empires. And it takes a long time after you've been the centre of the world to adjust to being normal. And to be the centre of an empire, you need to develop particularly nasty ways of thinking. You cannot send 12 men to guard the Khyber Pass without an inherent sense of superiority. And the British and the English in particular have developed that, and that's still kicking out of us. I think Brexit has got an enormous amount to do with that. Why are we not doing so well in the world, given that we are naturally superior? We know we're naturally superior because we have an empire. I came up a few years ago with five kind of things that are used to bolster inequality. There are people who believe inequality is good, and the wider it is, the better, because you're letting the market express itself. The first is that elitism is efficient. It is efficient to spend a lot of money on the education of a few children. £36,000 a year at Harrow and Eton, say, plus another £14,000 for the holidays and the skiing trips. £50,000 a year, aged 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 to 18, that's quarter of a million. For children, you're looking at a million, but you get a discount. Right? So why would you spend £1 million on educating four children in elite boarding schools? Because you believe that some children are specially gifted. That's why you put their name down at birth to go to Eton. And if you teach them right, they'll become great prime ministers and make Britain great again. And it doesn't make sense to spend much money on the lower orders because they could never amount to much, except for the occasional Michael Gove, who you kind of sweep up and turn into a minister. That philosophy is absolutely at the heart of the British education system. It's at the heart of the admission system at the university I work in, the search for the golden children who need special attention and tutorials to turn them into wonderful. Anyway, I've got four more, so I can't go on. Exclusion is necessary, poverty will always be with us. You're a fool to think that it can be diminished. We're always going to have people who are without much money. You want to make sure you don't have to live near them, but it's tricky because there's no point being rich if there aren't poor people near you. Because if you don't have people to make your bed and clean your house and cook your food, you're not rich. So the rich need the poor, but they always need to be excluded. Prejudice is natural. I think we saw this most recently in David Goodhart's pronouncements about who is a citizen of nowhere and a citizen of somewhere. Citizen of somewhere is another way of saying it's natural to be prejudiced. People are in tribes. Segregation is normal. Greed is good. The fourth one. You need the greedy, because without the greedy who are driven to get rich, nobody would do anything. Because people are fundamentally lazy. Most of you are lazy, but there may be one person in this room who will invent a new kind of vacuum cleaner. And that vacuum cleaner will employ a couple of dozen people in Wiltshire, and that will make Britain great again. That is Sir James Dyson. I mean, a ridiculous extent to this is, but anyway, greed is good. Despair is inevitable. It's as good as it gets. So I'm afraid that's life. Only a few people can get to the top. You can't have a better way. Now, I spent a long time making these more plausible when I felt a lot cynical about them. But these kind of things, I found evidence in conversations and in the footnotes of writing books to suggest that this is what people believe who advocate inequality. It took me years to realise, why does London have the highest house prices in Europe and the world? It's because we had a Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, who actually had a target of trying to get the house prices up. He was clever enough not to tell you that. But a measure of economic success for George, success, was that the city with the highest house prices in Europe is the economically most successful city. That's how he thinks. So he didn't see it as a problem. He introduced some help to buy to let a few Michael Goves through. But if you were not good enough to work hard enough to get enough money to be able to live here, then the market, the wonderful magic market, would tell you to go. But they don't tell you this is what they believe, because you don't tell people who have to vote for you that you think most of them are stupid and not up to much, because you need to get about 40% of them to vote for you. Repercussions. This graph here, I apologise, it's a bit small. This is the 20,000 extra people who died in the first 16 weeks of this year, above average, because we now have life expectancy flatlining. That's just the deaths that have occurred first week in January, second week, third week, fourth week. This is when, do you remember, all the operations were cancelled? So that people wouldn't die, so that the A&E could be open. And this is, even with doing that, we probably helped save lives. Even with doing that, we've had this huge increase in deaths. This is an increase on the mortality in the last 5 years, which was terrible. Britain to 1 month between 2010 and 2015, no increase in life expectancy. Finland a year, Norway a year, Japan a year. Everywhere else in Europe, an increase. Less in some places, more in others. The worst country for health in the whole of Europe, the UK, since 2010. Under May and Cameron. The last time this happened was during the Second World War. The more complicated graph, this is published by ONS, I think in autumn of last year. This is the league table of neonatal mortality. This is 1990. The best country in 1990 was Germany, then Sweden, then France, and Finland, Luxembourg, Denmark, and now it's us. We ranked 7th in 1990 by neonatal mortality rates. This is dying in the first 28 days of life. And way down here we have places like Portugal. When I was born, babies in Portugal died 3 times as often as babies in Britain. And now, 2005, we're now number 90. Below Croatia, Lithuania, Denmark. We're heading down rapidly. Portugal's up there. You're better off to be born in Portugal than Britain, but many other places. Since that graph was drawn, the infant mortality rate in Britain has risen twice. The last time the infant mortality rate in Britain rose twice was during World War II. I know I give too many stats, but honestly, the sad thing is, as I've got older, the statistics have become simpler. We used to have to work out quite complicated things to say we had a problem. Now we can literally just count increasing numbers of dead babies. Why do we think that the numbers of dead babies are related to inequality? This is a measure of inequality. Way back in 1983, it's how much the best off 1% were taking. That's the infant mortality rate in 2014. These are all the states of the USA. Once you add the states of the USA, things become a lot clearer. Right. And the Spirit Level book, almost 9 years old I think now, had lots of these. But the evidence since then that your level of inequality affects things such as a baby's chance of survival to year one is very high. Just zoom on. There are political consequences. Your politics divides more and more. You can see it in the States. The States is the only rich country that's worse than us, and of course it's got extreme political divide. That map is showing that there are areas where there are almost no conservatives and areas where half the electoral would vote conservative. In the past, we were much more mixed. In the past, you couldn't find areas where almost everybody was conservative and areas where almost nobody was. The graph there is the segregation index of conservative voters. How likely are you to meet somebody who's not a conservative, depending on where you live? And you can see that it rises and rises and rises until 2015. And then in 2017, we got the first fall in the segregation index for decades. The last peak, by the way, was 1918. What can be done about it? There are many, many things you can do. You can do things personally, you can talk to people about it, you can talk to people in your family about these things at work, when somebody suggests that the highest paid person should get a bigger pay rise than everybody else. You can make your views clear on that. Or you could just act politically. This graph was tweeted by a Conservative after the June election of last year, and it's showing that the biggest swing since 1945 occurred there, just a year ago. It's actually bigger than 1945, because the 45 swing occurred over 10 years. This occurred just over two. We're kind of very, very English over, oh, I'm not going to be impressed by that. But honestly, that was unexpected. You can change people's minds, and their minds can change faster than they've ever changed before. And that is what happened in May and June of last year. The biggest swing in public opinion for an election ever measured. And you can look at the good news. And there is the beginnings of lots of good news. The gap within the bottom 90% has been falling since the 1990s. The take of the 1% has been falling for a couple of years, but we didn't celebrate that because the 0.1% was still rising up. Last year, the High Pay Commission reported that the pay of chief executive officers in Britain had fallen by £1 million on average, but we didn't celebrate it, which is good because the gap is still too wide. And finally, a few weeks ago, the high point for me, at the very top of the tree when it comes to income, Martin Sorrell, a man who became rich by selling advertising around the world to get people to buy things they don't need so we can burn up the planet even faster. Martin Sorrell left his job, I'll put it like that for libel reasons. Martin Sorrell left his job and the highest salary of anybody in Britain that had ever been received, and he will not be replaced by anybody being paid that much. Martin Sorrell's resignation is the moment in the day of peak inequality in Britain, if you're being optimistic. Now, there's no guarantee that we're at the peak, but this is what the peak looks like. The bad news is, if you go back to 1913, hopefully we're not going to get a war, but the decade after the peak, and the decade after that, and the decade after that, doesn't feel that different as you come down. It's not until you get to the 1960s that things have fallen, and you finally begin to get the benefits of greater equality, and through to the 1970s, which are the best decade ever. If we could do it faster this time, there's no need to wait for 50 years, but it's galvanizing and happening. And finally, if you're feeling pessimistic, try and remember what things were like a few years ago. They are actually improving, they're getting better. Things that people said were impossible a few years ago have changed and happened. And then what happens is all the commentators who told you we can never publish statistics on the gap between men and women in every single company with more than 250 employees, who all told you, oh, that person can never be a leader of the party, or if they are a leader of the party, it'll fall apart and they'll never do well in an election. All those commentators changed their memory of what they believe they said to adapt to the new reality. And politically, things which are seen as unfeasible, say raising a top rate of income tax to 50%, 55, 60, whenever it's done, within a year, they become accepted and it's the new reality. People are used to it. And we have to remember that. It is not that hard because people adapt. A new government could abolish short-hold tenancies in one day in Parliament, simply cancels the act that makes it legal to give somebody a short-hold tenancy, and suddenly you've got rent regulation again. It's as easy as that. The hard thing is getting the government in. But get the government in, and the government can change an enormous amount very quickly. Lastly of all, if you go back to 1913 and the last peak, it does help to have a disaster. It does help to have a disaster. We tax the rich to pay for the First World War. So what you really want, if you want to hit the peak of inequality, is a really big disaster just on the horizon.
Not a World War.
Well, not a World War, but we do have something coming up on March 29th next year. Right? And in the run-up to that, maybe Britain's going to be great again, maybe we're going to be Empire 2.0, or just maybe, as we head towards that point, the confidence will go out, the house prices in London will carry on falling, the Conservative Party will rip itself to shreds, the country will run out of money, inflation will rise, you have to increase taxation simply just to get by. And it'll all feel terrible, but just quietly watch what happens to the inequality statistics as that happens. And remember, the disaster is entirely owned by the political party who decided to call that referendum. It is theirs. They own it. They need to be congratulated, if you like, for having inadvertently, possibly, helped ensure that we are at a peak of inequality. I've talked for too long, so I'll shut up. But thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. And now, Imogen.
I feel like what I'm going to say is more pessimistic.
Let's get it.
But I hope Danny's right. Do I need to? Okay. So. I'm coming at the question of inequality in quite a different way. So actually, Danny's work, I draw on a lot, it's really useful for my work, but I'm coming from more of what I call a cultural studies approach to thinking about inequality and the reproduction of inequality, and kind of expanding out to the concept of what we mean when we talk about inequality. So I'm going to start by reading this and see how far I go. So in Britain, the election of Conservative government in 2010 saw the introduction, as we know, of a wide range of austerity policies, which have seen draconian cuts in social provision at every level of British society, at every scale, targeted in particular at the welfare system and local government, from the slashing of welfare payments to vulnerable people, the underfunding of hospitals, schools, the closure of youth centres, libraries, museums, and much more. And in this book, which is, I really recommend, in fact, Danny and Kruger are in it, this edited book by Vicky Cooper and David Wyatt, is a really good account across a kind of interdisciplinary account across sort of social sciences about some of the impacts of those cuts. And their main argument, which they kind of re-evidence really well, is about the violence, actually, of austerity. And it's kind of it's profoundly violent outcomes in terms of things like levels of child poverty, mental ill health, and as Danny's shown, you know, literally the deaths of people. So the cuts which have flown from austerity have disproportionately impacted on those at the losing end of the British class structure, most notably children, disabled people, low-paid women, and of course, BME population in particular disproportionately impacted in the low-paid group because they are lower-paid. Over the last decade, it's become evident and undeniable even that these cuts are just impacting on things like life expectancy rates and these sort of trends and spikes and these kind of incredible statistics we've already seen. And I guess one of the main arguments that's been made in sociology and other sort of cognitive disciplines is that austerity is a kind of proxy term for something like a new class war because of the way it's disproportionately targeted and affected working class households and communities, and because of the way it protects concentrations of elite wealth and power. So that redistribution of wealth upwards that Daniel also talked about is kind of one of the key things we've seen happen since 2010 in particular. But I guess the question that I want to kind of focus on or open up as a question perhaps for discussion tonight is, how has this been achieved? So one of the things that I'm really interested in is questions of consent. So this is really a kind of following the footsteps of the great late Stuart Hall, thinking about what mechanisms of popular consent at work here that enable such devastating inequalities to be won. It seems to me that, you know, we've had a society, certain portions of which have now been decimated by a decade of austerity. And in all likelihood, if you're not as optimistic as Danny, we're facing a real austerity as opposed to a manufactured austerity in the post-Brexit period. So it seems imperative to me to pay critical attention to what these mechanisms are. And Thatcher famously said, economics is the method, but the object is to change the soul. Stuart Hall famously said, in coining the term Thatcherism, that there's also a little bit of Thatcher in all of us. He said that was one of the consequences of Thatcher. And what he meant by that is that Thatcherism isn't just a kind of economic model that's being imposed, if you like, by the elites, or a political or ideological model, but it's also something that remakes us in some way, remakes our subjectivities in some way. And that got me thinking a lot about what austerity has done to us, okay? So it's not what just done to our society, how we might measure it in the kind of graphic terms, but what has it done to the souls of people? And how has austerity as a kind of ideology, how have people come to believe in its value? How do you make people desire inequality? How do you sell the violence of austerity to an electorate in the context of what is still a formal democracy? Or put another way, how do the elites craft consent for a neoliberal project grounded in the production of inequalities, even at the point of the exposure of that logic with the financial crash in 2008-09? Even when the kind of that Wizard of Oz moment, the curtain is pulled back, we kind of see, if you like, what's been going on, and yet somehow there was a moment where it felt like something might change politically as a consequence, and in effect it didn't change very much at all. It chugged on, and austerity continues to chug on. The cuts continue. So these are questions I was thinking about. Is there kind of an austerity populism, if you like, of some kind? And in thinking about these questions, I've been thinking quite a lot about Theresa May. So I should say that a lot of my work is on refugees, migrants, and kind of ordering immigration policies, its effects in various ways. And so in a way, I kind of tracked Theresa May's career as Home Secretary and before that, Labour Home Secretaries before that. And so there's something about her that I find disturbing, obviously, and also interesting as a figure in terms of what her politics are. So I was thinking about Stuart Hall's work on Thatcherism, the way we diagnose Thatcherism, thinking, what is Mayism? How would we think about what kind of political project Mayism is? As opposed, for example, to think about Cameron and Osborne, where I think you could see quickly kind of where they sat politically, their investment in financial capitalism. Theresa May, I think, is more, in some ways, interesting case. How might we do a conjunctural analysis of Mayism, and how might that equip us in some way with critical tools to resist the politics of the state we're in? So that's a kind of question, I'm not going to answer it completely, but that's a question that is at the back of this paper. The other thing I want to say is about the broader context, which is about what you might call a politics of division that's more international. So one of the things that was interesting when Danny was showing the slides of the index is where Britain sits with Turkey, Russia, the US, and other states we might associate with a kind of rise of particular or different forms of authoritarianism. And I was interested in thinking about this Britain's place in this broader shift that we've seen since 2008-9 in particular, in terms of resurgence of things like far-right political ideologies and their kind of mainstreaming in different ways, ethno-nationalism and what I would call state racism, deepening economic inequalities, of course, and this increasing spatialization, heightened misogyny, disablism, erosion of legal and human rights frameworks, deepening religious intolerance, intensification, particular kinds of policing, securitization, surveillance, detention, imprisonment, and the role of propaganda. In particular, we've seen this has been most striking, I think, in liberal democracies, where state media, corporate media, and the weaponization of new media and big data become kind of features. Amnesty's report, and they do an annual report in 2016-17, their general secretary, Sale Shetty, said that what we're witnessing is this global trend towards what he described as an angrier and more divisive politics, in which the idea of human dignity is under vigorous and relentless assault from powerful narratives of blame, fear, and scapegoating, propagated by those who sought to take or cling on to power. Across the world, he says, leaders and politicians wage their future power on narratives of fear and disunity, pinning blame on the other for the real or manufactured grievances of the electorate. So situating Britain in the context of this, these global trends, start to think about how we can map that through in terms of austerity. So in Britain in 2008, we see, and from 2010, the election of Conservative or coalition government, we see immediately the propagation of an angrier and more divisive politics along what I would say is two primary tracks. The first of these I've already mentioned in terms of class and austerity, and I would call this a kind of politics of disposability. The punishment of the poor, and in particular the stigmatisation by politicians and media and other arms of the state, the stigmatisation of those who are deemed economically inactive, to use George Osborne's term. And we've had a decade, the first part of from 2010 up to probably 2015 in particular, we had this very intense period of the kind of creation of images, figures and stories which fueled public hostilities towards populations who imagined to be grey on this figure that appeared the hardworking taxpayer. And propaganda functioned as technologies of consent through which an anti-welfare common sense was affected. And there's been lots of work on this. What I'm saying here isn't new. Lots of media scholars and sociologists have done work on what's been going on in terms of the use of kind of media forms and as well as political rhetoric, etc., in the production of the legitimation of austerity. And this attempt to kind of put the blame for the financial crisis on this imagined parasitical underclass who were draining the welfare state that we couldn't afford anymore, in particular, I think, worked to disable, to some extent, opposition attempts to produce alternative political narratives. So I think, you know, there's a lot of work on this. This analysis, I think, is familiar now, but I think it only gets us so far. In order to understand how power operates at the level of the state, I think we need to get back to that question of changing souls that Thatcher talked about, to consider not only how states penetrate societies, but also kind of embraces them, surrounding them and taking hold of their members individually and collectively. So what I'm trying to say here is a popular consent for something like austerity, despite its violent impacts, is one when people come to invest in the imagined solutions being offered to them. So populism doesn't only mean the ability to secure electoral support for a political particular programme, but more than this, as Stuart Hall would say, or did say, but this is a quote, to ground neoliberal politics directly in an appeal to the people, to root them in essentialist categories of common sense experience and practical moralism, and to construct them. So what Stuart Hall, this is where it differs from a lot of other theorists, really emphasises is the way in which something like austerity is not only telling a story or trying to scapegoat in order to produce political legitimacy for a programme of devastating cuts to social provision, but in the process what it's doing is constructing new identities, it's constructing new types of people. It's not simply awakening existing classes, groups and interests, it's actually creating them or crafting them. So if we go back to Hall's account of Thatcherism and try and use this to think about what's shifted or changed since Thatcher was in power, she came into power in 1979, and she left in 1990, and then remember we had the Conservatives for a bit longer. But the revolution, or the revolutionary nature of her politics, Stuart Hall actually began mapping in the mid-70s, before she took power. And for him, Thatcher marked the beginning of a novel political project. And probably if we looked at Danny's graphs, so we saw him growing up in the 70s, you know, this period of the most equality we've ever had, and then basically we get Thatcher. And that's when things like start to massively shift. Thatcher's project, according to Hall, Thatcherism was a project to transform the state in order to restructure society, to dissenter, to displace the whole post-war formation, to reverse the political culture which formed the basis of the political settlement, the historic compromise between Labour and capital which had been in place from 45 onwards. And this is how Thatcher herself describes it, as popular capitalism. Popular capitalism is nothing less than a crusade to enfranchise the many in the economic life of the nation. We Conservatives are returning power to the people. This is the way to one nation, one people. So according to Hall's conjunctural analysis of the different forces that kind of created a populist project, which he called Thatcherism, there's certain things he thinks that she did. One was, and it's really interesting thinking about this now, I think in terms of the weaker version of populism we have now. Okay, one is that she enrolled the working classes and middle classes into the project of popular capitalism by telling them that they could be partners in this new entrepreneurial state. So she invited them to participate in the making of this new state by becoming stakeholders and literally to become shareholders in newly privatised industries. So basically she sold off gas, water, you name it, was sold off, nothing was left unsold except for things that are now being sold again subsequently. £50 billion was raised during her reign, and by the end of the 80s lots more adults had become actual shareholders, and some of us can still remember some of the adverts as probably some of the children inviting us to, you know, phone Sid or Ernie or whoever, you know, that appeal to the ordinary person, that appeal to become part of this new shareholder capitalism, to become part of the project of financial capitalism. So that's one of the forces in Hall's sense of work. But what Hall said that was the most novel about her project, one of the things that set it apart was the way she then fashioned that project to these values of the free market, liberalism, individual responsibility, self-reliance, etc., to socially conservative values. It was the marriage of those two things that he said constituted the distinctiveness of Thatcherism. So these conservative themes of tradition, family and nation, respectability, I think that's key, and patriarchalism and order. So this is a period, of course, where Section 28, the sort of suppression of minorities of various kinds who are seen to not conform to these conservative values and themes. So these two forces, Hall said, how she, one of the main ways she crafted consent for her radical project of free markets, participating in the spoils of capitalist enterprise, but by tethering this to these traditional conservative values. And in particular, and this is less talked about, is how the figure of a kind of native white working class emerges as a special subject of protection in this moment against both what was depicted as the red menace of the Cold War, but also against the red menace of what was depicted as the loony left. And we're seeing a lot of a re-emergence of that in the newspapers at the moment, but also as subjects of protection against mass immigration to Britain, particularly from the former colonies. Aptar Brahe argues that the embrace of Thatcherism spawned a new variety of nationalism. This sort of contradictory nationalism that harked back to imperial glories, and but also spoke of these threats to Britishness, or Englishness in particular, from these enemies within. And I think this is where, if you like, the reason Powell's here, you know, Powell is, this is the Powellist themes that were key to Thatcher. It was always in the background. It was a very, in a sense, Thatcherism is a very positive project, in the sense that it's a populist project. It wants to enroll people. But behind it is this fear that's being produced about this menace of these alien others who might come. So giving power back to the people was always also for Thatcher about taking back control, promising people that the state would be protected and that taking back control. And we see this in, this is where citizenship starts to really come into the Thatcher project. So in 1981, there's many more of these Citizenship and Nationality Acts. We see Thatcher really in 71-2, this was beginning, but 81 was a key moment, I think, where citizenship is redesigned. For the first time, in a way, we become citizens rather than just subjects under Thatcher. That's the moment we become citizens rather than subjects of the crown. And this is where black and Asian populations in the Commonwealth get excluded from citizenship at this moment. Okay. And this is what Powell said on the passing of this particular act. And this just really echoed to me some of the Brexit rhetoric, from the humiliation of having no nation, the people of the United Kingdom are now setting themselves free. So to go back to the present, taking back control. So I would say that around 2015, the figure of the welfare scrounger sort of peaking around 2013-14, started to kind of lose its power as a scapegoat for austerity. And actually, there's this other track. So there's these two dual tracks, and the other that had already been chugging along for a very long time is this idea of migrants milking the benefit system, or benefits tourists, this other discourse. And I said, at a certain point in the last few years, one dropped out, the figure of the kind of welfare citizen scrounger, and the migrant scrounger became much more prominent as a figure. So these two figures, who two scapegoats, feed off each other, as Burnett says, they're interlinked and they feed off and into each other in political and media representation. But this is, at this point in the story that I'm telling, Theresa May becomes really central. So this juncture, state racing comes into play in an unprecedented way. May was appointed Home Secretary in 2010, of course, with a promise in the manifesto pledge to radically reduce net migration. And she starts to, even though all the civil servants and the politicians didn't really mean it, because they knew it was impossible to reduce net migration in the context of free movement and the EU, in the context of human rights laws around refugees, etc. Nevertheless, she decided, you know, undeterred, to attempt to produce a context where people would leave, and in particular, deportation, but actually less forced deportations and voluntary returns, what she wanted to achieve. Fear and anxiety that would make people leave. And this, again, has been written about quite a lot, so you can go look at the hostile environment and the writing on it. And I think it came to a kind of head in 2014, when the Immigration Act 2014 came into law. And I think extraordinary moment here, so you get this kind of conjuncture in this act, these hostile welfare controls and hostile immigration controls. But the day the act came into force on June 29, Cameron and May, you might remember this, were filmed at the scene of a deportation, of a dawn raid and subsequent deportation arrests in Slough, where they actually, it was edited by ITN in a way that made them appear like they'd actually somehow participated in the dawn raid itself. There's this kind of real moment, I think extraordinary moment, where the two of the most senior politicians in the country are kind of, you know, at the scene of the dirty end of immigration control, actually at the scene of dawn raids themselves. And then we have Brexit, of course, and now austerity is reimagined magically as a problem that's kind of been created somehow by immigrants and by the EU, and it's going to be solved by taking back control of sovereignty and borders. So this is from the official Leave campaign. This idea that somehow the problems, as the electorate started to feel the impact of these cuts, of austerity cuts, somehow these problems could be solved by leaving the EU. It's a terrible bit of propaganda. And then leading up to this, but also particularly after Brexit, we get this idea that somehow the responsibility for the Brexit vote is because of this group called the Left Behind. Just during Thatcher, we get the police of the elite figuring of a native or white working class as a special subject of protection of the state. And they're employed, this figure is employed as an alibi to craft consent for actually a violent and continuing politics, I think, of dispossession. And here, this is where Hall's work is really important again. So he was said the Left Behind isn't an empirical category. There are left behind people. But he says that the way that that's racialised is a strategy of power, a tactic of division, a discursive construct that's come into being through the process of political activity itself. Okay. So talking about these two tracks, one I would call disposability, kind of politics of disposability that goes with neoliberalism, and the other is what I call a politics of deportability, which doesn't mean necessarily people being deported, but the making people deportable as a kind of way to create precariousness within the state are the two kind of features I think we've seen over the last decade. And I think this is a key part of it, what Robin Kelly says, is that we have to read this through the lens of racialization as creating this division within the state. It's the capacity of capital in the state to capture the white working class and tie its identity to race, is to whiteness and masculinity, which has always enabled capitalism. And at this moment of neoliberal capitalism, neoliberalism potentially collapsing, is what enables neoliberalism to reproduce itself at a moment of crisis. Okay. So I'm going to finish now.
Thank you very much indeed. And finally, we have the Cujo.
Right. weird adult onset allergies, and so I'm like snuffling because it's spring and I'm not used to warm weather anymore living in Britain. You might have heard when Danny was like, Britain is the Texas of Europe. I'm actually Texan, so I was like, yes! USA! USA! I was so delighted that like you guys are joining with us to go over the edge. I'm so happy. So I'd just like to say thank you to Joe for bringing us all together to talk a little bit about inequality in the UK. What I'm going to do is talk, and I'm not used to being in this position of kind of giving a ray of hope and light. My students normally say that these talks I give are like, I'm like the angel of death or something. So this is a weird position to be in, to kind of give you a sense of all is not lost from kind of very depressing kind of, kind of insights that Danny and Imogen have provided to us. So what I'm going to do is this. So what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about three-part tripartite catastrophe that my research project is based on, and of which Imogen and Danny have talked about. And I want to talk about what that means when we take seriously issues of intersectionality and race, class, and gender, and what happens to women of color under this tripartite catastrophe. But really the focus here, because I don't have a lot of time, is to talk about how these activists resist, and resist in very, very interesting ways. I will say that even though this is meant to be about inequality in the UK, this project that I'm working on is based in three countries, and I kind of want to share with you some of the preliminary findings from the Dutch context, which is interesting because everything that we're talking about obviously is not only happening in the UK or only happening in the USA, but we often only talk about these two centers, and they're very interesting, very similar things happening in the Dutch context, and in fact, the Dutch are kind of pioneers in a lot of this language, particularly in terms of the rise of the far right, so actually I think it's very interesting to understand what's happening there. This might offer some context about things are terrible everywhere. So not just, you know, so everywhere is the Texas of Texas. So I'll talk a little bit about that. And I want to talk quite a lot about the inequality of visibility. And that's the way into trying to understand women of color and how they organize, mobilize, and resist, and why we can't see them, and why it's a political project of both the left and the right not to see women of color as active agents. And the ways in which we understand that is through the imperial gaze, the concept I've taken from Bell Hooks. And then I'll finish with some findings from this ongoing research project. Okay, so I don't have to go through this in a lot of detail because luckily Danny and Imogen have done all the hard work for me, which is why I wanted to go last. Everyone's like, why do you want to go last? I was like, because you can do all the heavy lifting. And I can just kind of swan in and talk about other things. So this is me swanning in. So I don't have to go into this into a lot of detail, but just to highlight a couple of things, when we think about this, the current catastrophe, this tripartite catastrophe, just to go back briefly to talk about the 2008 economic crisis and subsequent austerity measures. So Leah Basil and I wrote this book called Minority Women and Austerity, Survival and Resistance in France and Britain, because all the figures that Danny showed you demonstrates the catastrophe of the rollback of the welfare state. But of course, that catastrophe is felt differently by different groups. And women of color are at the sharp end of these processes. And it's really important to understand that when we look at these high-level figures, it's always to disaggregate and insist on disaggregation, because then you can understand how women of color, despite their class position, have seen these dramatic falls in their income. And that's mostly because of their particular patterns of care and employment. So women of color are over-concentrated in the caring professions, teachers, social workers, carers, all the rest of it. So when you cut the welfare state, you're not only cutting the social safety net, but you're actually cutting their employment. So it's a double hit for women of color. But we've talked about that. The next thing is about the Mediterranean crisis. So I was at a horrifying European political science conference in Canada, of all places, last week. Lord. And it was interesting. I was at a panel about the crisis of social democracy in Europe, and people were like, oh, austerity. And I kind of asked a simple question of, does anyone think that the fiction of of European social solidarity has now been broken because of the Mediterranean crisis. And it was really interesting. People were like, it's fascinating. I've never thought about it like that before. And it's not because I'm like smart, but it's more horrifying that we see issues of austerity as somehow separate from the Mediterranean crisis. That European social solidarity, whatever that might mean, cannot and will not be extended to refugees, folks fleeing for their lives, literally fleeing for their lives. And so it's really important to understand that it is a European state policy to turn the Mediterranean Sea into a graveyard. It's important to understand that that is intentional, and that's part of the crisis that we have to take seriously. And then finally, the last part of the crisis is, of course, the rise and rise of the far right. Now, it's important to understand that the far right has not risen in the same way and at the same trajectory. It does not look the same in all places at all the same time. That's, of course, the case. But the issue about the mainstreaming and in the American lexicon, the normalization of extremist language, things such as turning the Mediterranean into a graveyard, as such, which is a prime example. But it's the mainstreaming of extremist language, but then also it's these breakthroughs in places that we never thought were these kinds of things would happen. And Germany is probably the best example of the AfD, proto-fascist party, is the third largest party in the Bundestag. And that's actually really important to understand because Germany is the leader in so many of these things, and the fact that these kinds of things are happening there, although I should say just as an aside, you shouldn't be surprised, but that's another story, but the fact that that's happening there matters in terms of how these issues are normalized. So with all that said, the question I always go back to are, where are women of color in this? How are they organizing? How are they mobilizing in this context of this catastrophe? And that's really the basis of my research project that I want to talk to you guys a little bit about this evening. And so just very briefly, just talk about methods. I know I'm really boring, but just so you know. So this is an ongoing project. The Dutch and English fieldwork is almost finished, and the American fieldwork is just about to start. So I'll talk to you a little bit about that. So, politics of catastrophe, very briefly, this is a small-scale qualitative research project looking at how women of color are organizing in three contexts, the US, the Netherlands, and the UK. And just very briefly about why these cities, because you kind of go to Boston, and I was like, when Danny was like, Texas, I was like, yes, I love the virtual circle. Anyway. I chose London and Amsterdam because these are, networks. These are cities with rich networks of women of color activists, and particularly in the Dutch context, we're seeing a revival of especially Afro-feminist activism that's taking place, which has really been sparked by something quite outside austerity and the rise of the far right. It's actually the ongoing grotesque displays of Zwarte Piet, Black Piet, which I'll go on to talk to you a little bit about. And the Netherlands is such an interesting case because all these things happen below the radar. So we don't, when we think about austerity in Britain, we don't actually think about the Dutch case. But the Dutch, back in, I think, 2011, said, we're moving away from a welfare state, we're moving to a participation society. And have gone through very similar processes of cutting back the welfare state, but also privatizing aspects of the welfare state. So very similar processes that we see in Britain, but we don't often think about the Dutch case. And I think we have a lot to learn from how people are organizing in this context. And the other thing, just to say very briefly about the Dutch case, is what was I going to say about the Dutch case? Well, I'll come back to that anyway. But I was like, there's something very interesting. Oh, of course, duh. The other thing is that, first Pim Fortuyn, but now Geert Wilders, they have been and continue to be inspirations for the European, but also the American far right. And so for some reason, we kind of overlook the Dutch in this case, but it's really important to understand how these very successful far-right parties, well, Pim Fortuyn, when he was assassinated, is kind of off the scene now, but Wilders in particular, what happens, what can you do, what are the ways in which you bring this in this context? And just very briefly about the US in this way, I was going to originally look at the Chicago case because there's some very interesting black radical and revolutionary organizing happening in the city. But then I was thinking about it, going, where we see real change is in the American South and particularly at the border. And I think, and I was thinking, it's not also just because I'm also Texan, I was like, I want to kind of do some research about my context as well. And then, and And so there's some really interesting work because Austin is a sanctuary city in a very conservative state. And so, you know, in Texas, all the large cities, which all of which were in the top 10 large cities in America, Dallas, Austin, Houston, are all sanctuary cities and are actually in a lawsuit against the Trump administration in order to protect undocumented migrants in these cities. So I thought this is an important case to try to understand. And what's also very interesting, unfortunately, is kind of my idea of you choosing Austin as a case has been proven correct in a quite horrifying way, because I don't know if you guys remember, there's the Austin bomber who is a far-right white evangelical terrorist planting bombs in a black middle-class suburb of the city. And so there's some quite terrifying far-right activism taking place in the city, as well as some really interesting black activism as well. So anyway, that's just some background context, and hopefully you will ask questions about that. Just very briefly, when we're defining key terms, when I'm talking about women of color, I'm talking about women who experience processes of racialization, gender hierarchy, and class domination. So please, whenever I talk about women of color activists, please don't ask me a question about where is the class in this, because I promise I cannot be polite anymore if you ask me a question about class. So that's just a warning that I don't want to ask me about class, but I'm just saying, it's taken care of. We got this. And then finally, I'm particularly interested in activists who are working against austerity, against the far right, and for migrants' rights in particular, working for and with undocumented migrants. So I just want to say a couple of things before I get into the good stuff of the findings about the imperial gaze. Because as I said, I'm particularly interested in the inequality of visibility and audibility. And why is it so difficult to see and take seriously women of color as political agents, as actors engaging in radical and revolutionary work? How can we explain and understand this? Well, I find kind of Mill Cook's very helpful in trying to understand what this why this might be. And she talks about this idea of the imperial gaze. And she defines the imperial gaze as, quote, the look that seeks to dominate, subjugate, and colonize. And I think that's incredibly helpful in terms of the framework to try to understand women of color's relationship to kind of public politics in this way, because when we think about the imperial gaze, what's important here is we have to get to grips with the looking relations, how we see and construct those who are, how we see and construct those who are seen as legitimate, who belongs in public space, and then who should be dismissed as the despised and disrespected other. And if we can get to grips with that, I think that would be very helpful. And I use the term imperial gaze rather than the white gaze, because that's all we want to show you, and the activists are having to deal with a lot of problems. It's not just about the relationships with the so-called white left, it's also with black radical men and other men of color. And so the imperial gaze that seems to subjugate, dominate, and colonize is not just with revolutionary white folks, it's also with so-called revolutionary men of color. And so it's really important to understand the horizontal violence that takes place in supposedly radical and revolutionary social movement spaces. And when we can get to grips with the imperial gaze, that then helps us understand the kinds of why women of color are underrepresented in so-called mainstream or traditional forms of politics. Because this underrepresentation is not an accident, it's not by chance, but it's a logic. It's a logic that assumes and demands women of color to be apolitical, to be passive objects, and to be acted upon and not seen as agents. But as I'm going to show you, what's really important to understand about this is that women of color's political behavior doesn't really map well onto the ways that we expect politics to look like. But if we're serious about disrupting the imperial gaze, we have to think differently about who gets to be an agent. We have to think differently about politics. Okay. So I'm going to show you some findings now, which I'm really excited about. So I'll be interested to know what you guys think about this. Firstly, I'm going to give you two. What I'm going to do for each of these findings is give you an example from the Dutch case and the English case, because even though you think these, you know, contexts are very different, the patterns are for me quite striking. And it'll be interesting to know what you guys think of this. So firstly, in terms of struggling against the imperial gaze, this is a Black Dutch anti-Zwarte Piet activist who's based in Amsterdam, and this interview was conducted in January of this year. So for those who don't know, Zwarte Piet, Black Piet, is this grotesque anti-Black caricature that is, and he functions, he's one of the minions of Sinterklaas, in the Dutch context. And so essentially over the past 6 or 7 years now, there's been a revival of radical black activism to try to kind of stop this kind of horrifying grotesquerie from taking place every year for about 2 weeks at the kind of end of November, beginning of December of every year is when the Dutch celebrate Christmas and have their Sinterklaas kind of celebrations. And so this is an activist, and this is what she talks about organizing in a anti-Zwarte Piet movement that she herself helped organize. So she's one of the founders of this movement, and this is about her experience in this movement. And this is what gets to this point about the imperial gaze and also the politics of visibility and the inequality of visibility. She says this, quote, "Black women always do the work. You will never see them in the foreground, but they will carry the organization. We participate so much in this movement, we need to have more space in decision making, receive more love and respect and appreciation. And it's not only in the Netherlands, I think it's everywhere I have been." And so, unsurprising, right? So anyone who knows their kind of black feminist politics and black feminist theory knows this is what women in the civil rights movement in the US have been talking about, this is what women in the ANC were talking about. So this is kind of the state of affairs. So even in movements where black women are part of the founders, they cannot be seen and cannot be heard. And in this case, she's not talking about the white Dutch left. She's talking about black men in the anti-Zwarte Piet movement who take up space, who shut them down, and tell them to, you know, get to the back, which is fascinating. And so this speaks to something quite important about the politics of and the inequality of visibility, that before activists can talk about the kinds of things they want to talk about, so in this case, the horrific anti-blackness of Zwarte Piet, they first have to fight for audibility and visibility in social media spaces. So very similar in the English context. So this is a Black British prison abolitionist. So this is an activist who helped occupy Holloway Prison last year as part of a joint demonstration. And so she talks about the difficulty of black middle class and working class women interacting with revolutionary white women in these supposedly radical spaces and the problems that she encountered. She talks about it in this way, which is very similar to the Dutch case, and even though it's a very different kind of context. She says, quote, "I feel like black women's contribution to organizing or the political culture in the UK has been erased. So there's a really rich history and tradition of black women organizing in the UK. It's not very well documented. It's almost as if we've been written out of history. It's almost as if we literally do not exist." And what's really, should not be surprising to you guys, right? This is nothing new. But what's interesting about this is this is part of the justification of not listening to women of color activists, not listening to black women, and it's part of the justification for assuming a passivity, assuming an apolitical operation of women of color. So that's in terms of the imperial gaze. What I want to do though, because that's kind of really depressing, what I want to show, and this is where the ray of light comes from, is to think about, well, how do women of color resist in the context of this tripartite catastrophe, but then also in the context of the imperial gaze. And I suppose what's really interesting about this is really taking seriously how the nature of women of color's political behavior and how they mobilize this idea of a politics of refusal. And this is really interesting. So this is a Dutch Surinamese anti-Zwarte Piet activist, and she talks about how her opposition is not merely to the white left, it's both the left and the right, and she's seeking to forge her own path because the mainline left and right cannot serve her interests. And this is really interesting stuff. So she talks about it like this. She says, quote, "We use left-wing and right-wing as innocent words, and it's actually about who can eat and who can't eat in this country, who can live and not live in this country. So I don't use left and right. I also think they're hiding words to not talk about things. They're like a mask. So we don't talk about how it really affects people's lives. So the party of wilders is called the Freedom Party, the VVD. But not understanding that is freedom, that is freedom that's built on the unfreedom of other people." And what's really interesting about this, she goes on to talk about how if you want to understand the rise of the right, you have to understand the retreat of multiculturalism. Because the rise of the right happened because the mainline social democratic parties, which you can map across Europe, start, you know, kind of bought into the extremist language, saying, oh, multiculturalism means that we support segregation. Multiculturalism means that our dominant culture, our white culture, is under threat. And so this is not just a politics of a pox on both your houses, but it's a recognition that to understand the success of the Freedom Party, the VVD, you also have to understand the collapse of the social democratic parties and how they refuse to take seriously a politics of anti-racism and refuse to take seriously a politics of a feminist politics as well. And in the English case, this is very interesting because you would think, oh, well, you know, mainline political parties, they're useless anyway on this stuff. But so in the English case, and this is a British Asian anti-deportations activist, so she works, sorry, this is my adult onset allergies kicking in. So she works with, so Imogen showed you examples of the go home or face arrest van. And so she was working in similar neighborhoods where those vans were sent around. And so she was part of the call chains to let people know that folks, that dawn raids were being instituted when immigration officers were on the street. She would do impromptu Know Your Rights events on the street. She was doing all of this kind of stuff. And so she's part of this kind of on the far left of radical politics. And she talks about this in terms of this politics of refusal. So it's not just about the mainline party. She says, quote, I generally tend not to trust anti-fascist groups because they tend to be really white. They have a real disregard for protecting people that might be more at risk in certain political spaces. It's been my ongoing gripe with white activist spaces. They don't recognize how some of us are more visible in those spaces and some of us are more at risk and can't do the same things that they do. So in this context, she's talking about how because women of color, so we, you know, operated this idea, I've been talking a lot about the issues of the inequality of visibility. Well, part of the inequality of visibility is also being hyper-visible in certain spaces and places, right? And so she and some of her comrades were dismissed as not sufficiently revolutionary and not sufficiently radical because they didn't want to participate in black bloc activities. So, you know, when kind of Antifa folks come together and all black and they do a whole thing. You know, this activist was like, well, you know, as an Asian woman, why would I get involved in that? Like, why would I, you know, I can obviously be picked out by the police. And also, because the criminal justice statistics are clear, people of color are more likely to be prosecuted, more likely to get longer sentences, more likely to get a jail sentence, all the rest of it. So why would we do that? And so this is what we mean about demanding, a certain kind of politics demands women of color to be passive objects. I'm almost done, I have 5 minutes left. Oh, all right. I'm gonna try to end on kind of hopefully more a bright spot. And I want to talk a little bit about the particular features of women of color in politics under this tripartite catastrophe, and that's really thinking about activism. This activist talks about invisible activism or activism in liminal spaces, which I think is very interesting. He does work with undocumented migrants in Amsterdam, and she talks about her work like this. She says, quote, her work with bringing undocumented migrants together with kind of white Dutch citizens in the city. She says, quote, I call it a kind of invisible activism. I believe very much in operating in a liminal space that creates a lot of possibilities. By keeping it very low key, it's possible to get a lot of things done. So that's the kind of clash that takes place. That creates a kind of discomfort. But with that discomfort, something happens, which is that these white Dutch people become completely silent. And that silence actually creates a window, creating a window for those voices that are always silenced by the dominant culture. And so I think what's really important when we think about this is how we're defining what radical politics is, and why this constitutes a politics of survival and why this can be seen as revolutionary, right? Because she brings together, she talks about this clash of perception between undocumented migrants who are literally being hunted in the streets of Amsterdam, as we see similarly in the UK context, but then also forcing the silence and really making people discomforted in this kind of, in the Dutch context, you see again and again, people complaining about this white saviorism, this white savior syndrome, particularly with undocumented migrants. it creates this kind of clash where the disrespected and despised other is now able to be seen outside of the imperial gates, but also is able to be heard, which I think is very interesting. I'll finish with just this final quote, and this is from another British Asian anti-deportations activist. And I gave a talk at the LSE back in January where I talked about this idea of a politics of care, and how caring for others, caring for and about others, is a window to a kind of prefigurative politics for women of color. And what we see is the same kind of thing happening, same kinds of concerns. If only we could see that and understand that as revolutionary radical politics would be getting somewhere. But I just want to kind of finish with this, I think, quite inspirational way of thinking about activism that doesn't map well onto the traditional ways that we think about what activism is and what it looks like and what it should achieve. So she says this, quote, "We know that those things that we're struggling against are not realistically going to end in our lifetime. So how do we make sure that people can survive?" So that's that politics of survival. "Limiting harm does mean destroying most of the systems around us." Like, that plays out in quite a radical way. But I think my core belief is looking after people, protecting them from harm, not wanting them to be destroyed by the things that are very intent and very good at destroying exactly those people. And so, as like all the activists, they're like, get out of here with your Marxism and your socialism and all the rest of it. This is, you know, they say the foundation of what they do is about care and protection for others, particularly the despised and disrespected other. And guess what? We get to the same place, right? The destruction of the state, right? So we still get to the same place, but the starting point is different, which I think is very interesting. But there's a problem here. It's a failure of political imagination, but also some logic of our current politics that cannot see and will not recognize that as radical politics, or even see that as a kind of politics. So just to say very briefly, Imogen and Danny were really great about talking about the material inequalities, but we always have to link the material inequalities to discursive inequalities, that those who are more on the sharpest end of inequality are also those who are more likely to be silenced from our public politics. But the good news is that women of color, often operating below the radar in those liminal spaces, refuse this category, and also the politics that demand it. And if we take seriously what we can see this politics, but only if we take seriously this idea that care and protection for others is a window into the new world and perhaps a foundation for a radical new future. Thank you.